You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
For 60 years, he has held many positions, many titles. I think, to my mind, the word ambassador might best characterize both the substance and the spirit of his life's work. But one should note that Ambassador Brahimi actually began his career as a freedom fighter, leaving his studies in Paris in 1956 to join Algeria's national liberation struggle. And after independence, he was called upon to serve his country in a variety of diplomatic roles as ambassador to the United Kingdom, to Egypt, to the Arab League, and from 1991 to 1993 as Minister of Foreign Affairs. But by 1994, your reputation had preceded you, and you found your way onto a wider international stage at the United Nations. And over the next 20 years, he would serve as UN Special Envoy or Special Representative in a series of truly challenging diplomatic assignments in places like Yemen, South Africa, Haiti, Zaire, Sudan, and Nigeria, just to name a few. He served as the Secretary General's Special Representative for Afghanistan from 1997 to 1999, and again from 2001 to 2004. In 2004, he was named UN Special Envoy to Iraq, and a decade later, he was appointed to a similar role in Syria. He's the author of a UN report, which actually bears his name, the Brahimi Report. It was written in the aftermath of the failings of UN peacekeeping operations in Rwanda and Srebrenica. And it remains one of the foundational documents in the doctrine of UN peace operations. I think importantly, in 2007, he became one of the founding members of a group called the Elders, a group of distinguished senior statespersons dedicated to the cause of peace, justice, human rights, and environmental sustainability. His partners in that undertaking included such notables as the late Nelson Mandela, former Irish President Mary Robinson, Liberia's former President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the late Bishop Desmond Tutu, and the late Kofi Annan. Ambassador Brahimi is no stranger to this house, and it is indeed a privilege to have him back with us today, along with members of his family, to reflect on his extraordinary journey and the lessons that we may all glean from his extraordinary experiences. Ambassador Brahimi, obviously there is no way that we can do justice to your long and distinguished career in the limited amount of time allotted to us this evening. But if I may, I'd like to sort of begin at the beginning with your experience as a freedom fighter. And I'd like to ask, and it brings to mind, of course, the journey of another freedom fighter who also went on to become a noted peacemaker, one of our most noted peacemakers of our time, Nelson Mandela. And I wanted to ask, first and foremost, what motivated you to make this transition from freedom fighter to diplomat? But also how that experience as a member of the Algerian national liberation struggle has informed your work over the years as a peacemaker and as a peace builder.
Ambassador Moose, thank you very, very much indeed for the honor of receiving me in this house. And I am extremely grateful to the people who were kind enough to take time to come and listen to us. I would like to apologize beforehand. I'm not as young as I used to be when I started, in particular. My eyesight is not as good as it used to be. My hearing is not as good as it used to be. And more important, my memory is not as good as it used to be. So I'll try to remember, you know. They say that one remembers better things that come from, you know, 60, 70, 80 years ago than about lunch yesterday. You know, in the 1954, Algerians were very surprised to read a declaration by something that we didn't know existed, called the National Front of Liberation, which appeared on the 1st of November. We saw it, as a matter of fact, on the 2nd of November, that said that we are going to start a war of liberation.
Right.
A lot of people inside the Algeria and outside said it was crazy. The people, who are they? What is it? How are they going to fight a war against France, NATO, and so on? And for us young people in those days, welcoming that declaration was the most natural thing to do. So as students, we had just created our national student organization. We immediately adhered to this and were trying to find who these people are and how do we join. Yeah. In my case, I was in Paris. I was part of the leadership of our student organization, and we received in, I think, January 1956, an invitation from the Indonesian students who said, we are organizing a student conference in the city of Bandung to commemorate the first anniversary of the big Bandung conference that had taken place in April 1955. And to cut a long story short, a very, very good friend of mine who was the president of our chapter in Algiers, and I, who was vice president of the executive committee in charge of foreign relations, were picked up to go to Jakarta, to Bandung, for this conference. The FLN got in touch with us, the Liberation Movement, and said, we will pay your tickets, but you don't come back. You join the our representation abroad, and they will tell you what to do. So we went to Cairo, where the office of the Liberation Army was there, and they gave us our marching orders. Go to Indonesia, attend your conference, and then stay in Jakarta and open our first office in Asia.
Diplomatic representation.
Yeah. And that Ben Yahya, who knew some English, would stay in Jakarta. I would learn some English and go and open the office in New Delhi. But Ben Yahya fell sick, and instead of going to Delhi, I stayed in Jakarta for 5 years. Those 5 years were really formative years for me.
Yes.
Not in school, not in university, but through the contacts that I had with government, trade unions, political parties, NGOs, and the like, I really learned a great deal there, and very, very grateful to Indonesia for what I have taken away from there. In addition, of course, to the work that we did to make our struggle known and gain support, not only political support, which we had already right. in a country like Indonesia, but also material and even military support. So that is how mm-hmm. how I went from, you know, from there on I never chosen, I have never path. Chosen what to do. Yeah. It has always been decided for me.
And you've said that in fact what you learned, one of the things you learned from that experience was just how important the building of that international support was
oh, yeah, sure.
to the ultimate success yeah. of the Algerian liberation.
People said that the Algerian struggle for independence owes at least as much and perhaps more mm-hmm. to the work we did outside with the support of our friends than to the actual
just
war
fighting on the ground, yeah. country.
It's not true. Mm. The war was really the deciding factor, but I think the work outside has contributed something.
One could imagine that experience, that was, we forget how brutal the Algerian war was.
It was.
And one could well imagine that is an experience that could have embittered you and indeed turned you away from this idea of being a peace builder, but it did not.
I think that we had become already part of the freedom fighting in Africa, and we were very, very close to all the movements elsewhere in Africa,
across Africa, yeah.
including the ANC, Portuguese colonies, and so on. We were very, very close indeed. And I was fortunate to know a lot of people. The last one being Mandela. Whom I met only after he was freed in 1990. And I met him in South Africa, where I went to observe as the leader of the UNOMSA, the observer mission of the United Nations in South Africa. It was quite an adventure.
Yeah.
It was a natural thing that those of us who had worked outside, and by the way, we never called ourselves diplomats. Mm. We were members of the National Liberation Front who happened to be outside for one reason or another and were mobilized by the party, by the liberation movement, to do work for the cause. But it was the natural thing to go back home in 1962 and create the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Yes.
First, as a matter of fact, in Cairo and Tunis, because we had created a provisional government in exile,
yeah.
and we created the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the government in exile in Cairo and Tunis, and then we moved to Algiers in 1962,
and that was of course what paved the way for your subsequent diplomatic roles as ambassador to the UK.
Then we became real diplomats.
Then you became the title. And eventually as foreign minister and during that period. But your reputation became very widely known, and you were looked to by the Arab League, for example, and by the United Nations to assume larger roles, diplomatic roles on the international stage. One of the earliest missions, difficult challenges you were presented with was representing the Arab League and in a way the United Nations in Lebanon. Can you tell us a bit about what that experience was like?
See, Lebanon was engulfed in a civil war which started in 1974-75. I was asked by the Arab League to try and see if we can help the Lebanese end their civil war in 1998. First by an Arab League committee of six countries, and then by a presidential committee of three. The kings of Saudi Arabia and Morocco and the president of Algeria. I arrived there at the right time because there had been attempts to mediate by the Arab League and by the United Nations and by the United States throughout those 14 years that preceded me, but time was not right. I arrived at the right time, and we managed to end the fighting and start, you know, the helping Lebanon to organize itself on a new basis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, to cut a very long story short, you know, there was a Syrian army in Lebanon.
Right.
And I think that by that time, 1988, 89, they weren't very popular in Lebanon. But they didn't want to leave. So we had serious problems getting them to leave. And we thought that we had found a way of moving in that direction and getting Lebanon to recover its total freedom and independence. When a terrible event happened. So I'm talking about 88, 89,
yes.
1990. Iraq invaded
Kuwait. Yes, right.
And from that time on, Lebanon was forgotten.
Yeah.
And the committee of three heads of states wanted to continue to help Lebanon. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we had decided that we would organize in Geneva an international conference to collect some money for the reconstruction of Lebanon.
Yeah.
And all that, of course,
sort of evaporated because of the situation.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you succeeded where others had failed in at least putting together a basis for
The Taif agreement was.
Yes.
I mean, they you know, I don't know if there are. I mean, yeah, I know that there are a couple of friends from Lebanon here.
Yeah.
I hope they'll forgive me if I say that until now. The Lebanese, quite a few Lebanese, say that Taif agreement is horrible, and in the second part of the sentence they say we cannot do without it. So this is where
this is the
where
essence
we are now, and
you
know all the problems of Lebanon and of Syria and of the entire region. That you know,
perhaps we can come back a little later to talk about. Syria, fair to say, isn't it, that your role, particularly in the Taif agreement, got you a lot of attention, understandably so.
Yeah.
And then you were then invited, asked by the United Nations, to play the role that you just referred to, namely, you used the word observing. It was more than observation,
as
we all know in South Africa. I think it's fair to say that that election could not have taken place but for the role that the UN played. Can you, and I think you refer to it as one of your most rewarding and satisfying experiences. Can you talk a little bit about
South Africa,
how that happened? As I also recall, that's where you actually met Kofi Annan for the first time. So all these things come together.
I had already done a couple of things for the UN in Africa.
Yeah.
And in November 1993. Mm-hmm. Boutros Ghali said, you know, we have a mission in South Africa, but now it's in the last phase. Mm-hmm. I would like you to go and lead it. I went to South Africa in December 1993, and I immediately went to Shell House, as the ANC, where the ANC was, right, and met Mandela,
yes,
for the first time.
Right.
We had, I think we stayed a couple of hours together, and he showed me how well he knew the country, although he had been arrested.
Even though he had been 27 years in
Robben Island. And had been back on the streets only for 4 years.
Right. Yeah.
One of the things he told me is that, there is one of the white extremists. Mm-hmm. I think you should go and see him.
Yes.
What for?
Yeah.
He told me, I think, mm-hmm. So the name is Constant Viljoen.
Viljoen,
a former general.
Yes, indeed.
Who headed a small party, very extremist. Mm-hmm. I asked an appointment. He refused. He said, United Nations is partly responsible for all our problems. Mm-hmm. No, I have no time for you. But Mandela told me, you insist. I insisted, and he finally received me, and we had a discussion. It was very tense at the beginning, and I told him, do you know anybody in the ANC? Mm. He told me, no. Mm. Yes, one, Mbeki.
Mbeki.
I said, what do you think of him? He said, yeah, he's all right. It's better than Mandela. Mandela is. So I told him, but do you know who asked me to come and see you? He said, who? I said, Nelson Mandela. He said, why? What? He said, yes, he asked me to see you. And he thinks that there is room for everybody in the new South Africa.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah.
He registered as a candidate 2 minutes before the midnight, the last day. And after the election, I received a phone call from Mr. Viljoen, who said, yes, can I come and see you? Mm-hmm. Yes, with great pleasure. He said, I'm bringing some people with me. Who are they? He said, the Union of Farmers, the most extreme organization. I said, come. They came, and these people came to see the United Nations to ask if they can go and work in other countries in Africa. So you see the changes that have taken place, and the election in April was a terrible mess. But there was leadership,
yes,
in the country, and Mandela and de Klerk sat down and solved all the problems in 2 days.
Yeah, indeed, it was quite a partnership.
De Klerk will tell us a bit later when Boutros Ghali came for the inauguration of Mandela, and he was the second vice president, not the first vice president. He told us that this election is not about forming a government. It is about ending apartheid. Mm. We had agreed to end apartheid, and apartheid is ending. So it is a success, and we could have asked for the redoing the election in 100 constituency. But what for? The ANC will have won them anyway. So there was leadership.
But there was also, frankly, the legitimacy that the presence and the leadership of the UN conferred upon
Israel.
Without which there wouldn't have been any credibility for them.
In fact, Mandela was released on the 11th of February 1990.
Yep.
And he, on the evening of that day, he made his famous speech in first time people saw somebody new called Mandela that had not even a picture, because the apartheid regime did not allow him to have a picture taken. So they were waiting for somebody to say, you know, how much he suffered, how much it is, and they saw a white-haired giant saying that, you know, let's now build our country together.
Yeah.
That was unbelievable. Okay. And he ended his speech with a quote from the speech he had made to defend himself in 1964. 1964 to 1990 is 26 years, is it?
26, yes.
Yes,
indeed.
In that speech, in the speech on the 11th of February 1990, people admired his conclusion, because he was saying that, you know, I worked for peace and democracy and so on.
Yeah.
And nobody realized then that this was from his speech in 1964.
In 1964, indeed.
And I often tell, especially young people, students, if Mandela had been heard in 1964, rather than in 1990.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the time, lives, waste that we would have spared ourselves and the people of South Africa.
True. I'm reminded again of the parallels between your journey and his, coming out of that liberation struggle. Very violent and brutal.
Yeah, but you see,
but yet embracing.
Yeah, he's really an incredible man.
Yeah.
When I was leaving,
if I may tell you a story.
Yeah. When I was leaving, I want to say goodbye to him. He was then Mr.
Right.
President.
Yes.
He told me, come, let's go and have lunch at home. Mm-hmm. So we went and had lunch at home. And 2 or 3 days before that, we are in June 1994, one of the worst racist leaders of South Africa, white South, called Terre Blanche,
yes.
Eugene Terre Blanche, was asked by the press, said, you know, now,
yes.
Mandela is president, are you going to go and see him? And he said, what? Never. I will never accept a black man as president of my country.
Right.
And of course, the press went to Mandela. Have you seen
what
Terre Blanche has said?
Yeah.
And Mandela said, yes, I have. Mm-hmm. And what is your comment? He said, no, I have no comment. He said, no, this man has spoken about you in these terms and so on. He said, no, he's free to, he's a South African, So, when we had lunch, we were driving back to his office. He was then living in a small apartment alone. Mm-hmm. And when we were driving back, I told him, look, I'm leaving, and I cannot, go without telling you. Why did you say that about Terre Blanche?
Yes.
Because he said, if he asked, they told him, if he now asks to see you, he said, yeah, I'll see him. I said, why did you say that?
Why did you say that?
I come from the other end, the northern of the continent, and if I met Terre Blanche, I would not shake his hand. He laughed. He said, you are very polite. because our young people are, you know, criticizing me in much stronger terms. Yeah. But stop to think of something.
Yes.
You think that Terre Blanche is the only one who thinks that the blacks ruling South Africa is not something acceptable. Mm. Most of the whites must be like that. Mm. How can we convince them that they can live in South Africa run by a black man? And most probably they are going to have black presidents for quite some time.
Yeah.
So you see, this is the kind of man who came out of prison. And you know, what I think of is, what if he had been, if he had come out of jail in 1964?
Instead of in
1990. Rather than in 1990.
26 years ago. Yeah. Combat. Yeah. But I noted one of the things you said to me earlier in the day is one of the things, the lessons you learned along the way, which also is embodied in what Nelson Mandela said when he said, go talk to General Viljoen, was that never refuse to listen to anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is something I didn't learn from Mandela.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have learned it from Mr. Alan Dulles.
Okay.
Because you know, it is said that when he was consul in Switzerland and was creating the Secret Service or whatever it's called of the United States in the First World War,
yes.
He was there was a man, a Russian refugee in Zurich, who was asking to see him. You know, mm-hmm. Month after month, year after year. And he had no time to see this Russian. And then in 1917, he learned that that man was Mr. Lenin.
Yeah.
So it is said that Alan Dulles, after that, said, I will never refuse to receive anybody. Yeah. So,
if we could perhaps maybe fast forward to another challenging, distinctively challenging mission, which was Afghanistan. So, you were chosen to serve as the UN Special Envoy to Afghanistan. And of course, after the US forces ousted the Taliban following the 9/11 attacks, you were the one who presided over the conference in Bonn that led to the agreement that gave birth to the Democratic State Republic of Afghanistan. Here we are, two decades later. On occasion, you have called the failure to include the Taliban in the initial negotiations going all the way back to 2001, 2002, as an original sin, which has led us to the current situation where the Taliban is back in power. Looking back on all of that, lessons would you have us draw from our engagement, our involvement, our intervention in Afghanistan over the years?
There are, you know, few things that were important to me in the course of this period that I have spent dealing with Afghanistan.
Hmm.
The first one, before the 2001 military intervention of the United States and others, in that period, the international community as a whole, including the humanitarians, practically refused to talk to the Taliban. I talked to them. They also, at the beginning, were refusing to talk to us. Yeah. But they accepted to talk to us when they actually swept most of the country in 1998, the summer of 1998. And they arrived in Mazar Sharif in the north, the big city in the north. And they killed 9 diplomats from Iran in the consulate of Mazar Sharif. The Iranians massed 200,000 soldiers and were on planning to invade Afghanistan. But then President Khatami of Iran came in September. We are talking about this happened in August. Khatami came in September for the General Assembly in New York. And he told Kofi Annan, please help us avoid the war. So, you know, Kofi told me to go there, go, and I saw Muhammad Omar, the leader of the Taliban. We, you know, took quite some time, effort, and so on, but we managed to. You know, they killed these nine diplomats, and they arrested all the Iranians they found in Mazar Sharif, about 100 plus. So we managed to get
avoid a war.
The bodies of the 9 Iranians and all the prisoners or hostages, as we would say. You know, because of that, Mullah Muhammad Omar accepted to see me twice after that. And again, I ask my question, you know, if a lot of people had seen Mullah Muhammad Omar, what would have happened? Maybe things would have changed already, and, you know, I had discovered or suspected that Bin Laden was doing things or preparing things that were, and I told the Taliban, and I told the Americans and a lot of other people. Nobody listened until the 2 embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam were attacked. So, you know, talking to people is not bad, and it can be extremely useful. When we came back in 2001, a lot of people say that in Bonn we should have asked the Taliban. That's not a good. That was not possible. They had just been routed and expelled from Kabul by the Americans. They wouldn't have accepted to come, and the Americans wouldn't have allowed to come.
True.
But when we went to Kabul in December 2001, the obvious question was. I mean, these people were controlling 95% of the country.
Yeah.
Where are they? Shouldn't we find out where they are and maybe talk to them and see what they are thinking, what they are doing, and so on? And total niyat from everybody, Afghans and non-Afghans. What I have learned, how long it is, 22 years later, that's last year,
that's right,
is that some leaders of the Taliban in early 2002 had written to President Karzai saying we are willing to recognize the new dispensation on only one condition. We return to our villages and we want to be allowed to live in dignity. President Karzai never told me one word about that. And again, just imagine
what if history we had, would have been.
So, you know, losing opportunities is costly at the end of the day. Anyway, you know, what we did, you know, is held Lohia Jirga, which is Grand Assembly of You know, in the days of the monarchy, it was the king would just get up and send people and ask people, heads of tribes and so on, to come to Kabul, they have dinner, and he will tell them what he wants to tell them. But they, we organized it in a slightly different way. And we had first Loya Jirga in June 2002. And the second Loya Jirga, constitutional Loya Jirga, in November, December 2003, just before I left. Both were, I think, successful, although we were bitterly criticized, and I was, you know, bitterly criticized, including by some people from music.
Okay.
Anyway, you know, so. We put together the beginning of a republic. It's called the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. For the 2 years I was there, we had near total peace, a little bit like what we have now in Afghanistan. But things started to deteriorate in 2004 and went on deteriorating.
So part of the reason for that, though, was there was a pivot, certainly here in Washington, from Afghanistan to Iraq.
Yeah. You are absolutely right, yes.
And, you know, whereas in Afghanistan, you know, we had a propitious beginning because we had the entire international community, the Security Council, the General Assembly, all supporting the intervention to end the threat of terrorism that clearly was palpable in Afghanistan. Iraq was just the opposite.
Yeah.
So in Iraq, we had a situation where
there is a very, very important point to make there in Afghanistan.
Yes.
What I heard much later was that after 9/11, the first meeting in the Pentagon was not about Afghanistan; it was about Iraq.
It was about, I think history will bear that.
And we found out much, you know, after the event, that as a matter of fact, for a lot of people, Afghanistan was done once the Taliban were punished. And the Americans were already looking to
Baghdad, already looking to Iraq
like that, and therefore the help was in Afghanistan was not as as important as it should be.
So in Iraq, the United States, in with partners, intervenes. Kofi Annan in October is moved to deliver a statement in the General Assembly, in which he strongly criticizes our intervention. Yeah. As being contrary to international law and, moreover, undermining the international rules-based system. And fair to say that the relations between the 38th floor in the United Nations headquarters and the Oval Office here in Washington hadn't been frostier.
Frosty, yeah.
But 6 months later, not even, it was less than 6 months, it's only 3 or 4 months later. It's the Bush administration that is eagerly reaching out to the UN and to you specifically to come and help deal with the situation that had been created in Iraq. And in fact, you, as I recall, you were actually invited to come to Washington to meet with President Bush at the White House. What was it that the Bush administration thought that the UN could do, and more particularly you personally could do, that the United States with all its military power in Iraq could not?
You know, I think let me just read another statement.
Yes.
Of Kofi Annan, if I manage to find it. In February.
Yes.
1998.
February 1998.
Kofi invited the members of the Security Council to his office.
Okay.
He didn't go down to them.
Okay.
So that it was not a meeting of the Security Council.
Right.
Yeah. And he told them, I'm going to Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. By at that time, there was a big tension because the Americans and the British wanted to expand their inspection, the work of ANSCOM, to everywhere, including the palaces of Saddam Hussein.
Yes, I recall.
Of course, Saddam refused.
Yes.
And Kofi decided to go to Baghdad to see if he can make a deal. He did make a deal. I was with him. And when he returned, he was received, he was given a hero's welcome at the United Nations. And I think the people who received him in Washington represented the opinion of the world.
Yes.
They didn't want wars and to continue. Few months later, I think in December of 2018, the Americans and the British bombed Iraq again. And this is what Kofi Annan said.
Mm.
This is a sad day for the United Nations and for the world. Mm. My thoughts tonight are with the people of Iraq, with the 307 United Nations humanitarian workers who remain in the country, and with all others who live, whose lives are in danger. It is also very sad for me personally. Throughout this year, I have done everything in my power to ensure peaceful compliance with Security Council resolution and to avert the use of force. This has not been an easy or painless process. It has required patience, determination, and the will to seek peace even when all signs pointed to war. However daunting the task, the United Nations had to try as long as any hope for peace remained. I deeply regret that today these efforts have proven not to be sufficient. What has happened cannot be reversed, nor can any of us foresee the future. All we know is that tomorrow, as yesterday, there will be still an acute need in Iraq and in the wider region for humanitarian relief and healing diplomacy. In both these tasks, the United Nations will be ready as ever to play its part. So, this is the way for the Secretary General to be extremely critical of what two important members had done. We moved from there to 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq. The Americans and the British came first time and asked for the UN to come to Iraq. And a lot of people advised Kofi Annan to say no. But he said yes. And President Bush invited Sergio Vieira de Mello.
Mm-hmm. Sergio, yeah.
Because, of course, Sergio had said no. After this invitation, he had to say yes. And he died on the 19th of August, 2003. I made the mistake of coming from Kabul to the UN instead of going to on holiday. And I think what the Americans saw was especially the success of the constitutional lawyer Jirga.
It wasn't easy at all, but
we managed to get the constitution for Afghanistan. And that is, they came to New York, Mr. Bremer and the governing council, all 15 of them, and they said that we want the UN back, and we want Brahimi to lead the team.
So a complete turnabout from where they started the conversation, saying that the US and the UK were going to manage Iraq, to a recognition that frankly they couldn't do it.
In June, they had come to the Security Council and got from the Security Council a an agreement that they will govern.
They were
they
the
govern
authority.
Jointly Iraq. Now they say we want to restore Iraq's sovereignty, and we cannot do it without the UN.
We can't do it without the UN.
So I want to see President Bush.
He, yes.
You know, we didn't say much, but I spoke to Kofi, who was then in London, and he told me, you know, as I told you, the UN cannot say no, but you are free.
But do you think you can say no
now that the President of the United States has asked you and said yes? And in less than a month later, we were in Baghdad.
So I know that you've said that Iraq was probably your most difficult, the challenging assignment, not least because you were there with the US and the UK. But
with invaders.
Imagine, what would Iraq be today had you not agreed to take on that role?
I wasn't at ease in Baghdad throughout the 5 months I was there. But the work was also extremely difficult, very, very difficult. I thought I knew Iraq. I didn't. You know, I knew Iraq in the 50s and the 60s.
Yeah.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
I met one man I liked very, very much. I remembered him as in his 40s, a beautiful black-haired man, and I find a man with a cane like mine. And so the Iraq of 2004, I didn't know. So I had to learn, and extremely difficult, very, very difficult. But I of course, the Americans were not able to see Ayatollah Sistani, who was the most influential religious leader in the country.
Yes,
I went to see him, and I came out from his office and made a statement saying that we will have. We agreed, Ayatollah Sistani and I have agreed that we'll have, Iraq will try to have an election at as early as possible in 2005.
Yes.
On condition there is security. And we went back to New York, and we tried to talk to the Americans that there was no security. There wasn't real security. That you should postpone a little bit the election, but the Americans needed the election
keen,
to take
keen
place.
To get
it has
the
taken place.
Behind.
It wasn't that bad.
Yes, but it would not have. It would have been far worse.
The last words I would like to say is that. That invasion was not negative because it has destroyed a lot of the country. It has been negative because people were complaining about the corruption in Saddam's regime. But under Saddam, the corruption was just around him. After the invasion, corruption
was everywhere.
Until today, it's absolutely horrible. Anyway,
There are so many other things that I would love to talk to you about, but I see that we're already running out of time. I'm going to keep people here for a little bit longer because we cannot allow you to leave without talking about the Middle East. The Middle East, because you know, throughout your many assignments in the Middle East and elsewhere, as well as your more recent work with the elders, the Israeli-Palestinian issue has been a constant overarching preoccupation.
Sure.
And I think you can say that it has been the central driver of the politics and the conflict dynamics throughout the region and beyond. In 2017, you were invited to address the UN Security Council on the subject of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. As one of many occasions in which you advocated for an end to the occupation of the Palestinian territories. Now, you once said in a different context, you were talking about Cyprus when you were with the elders, and you said, and I quote, says, "Never in my career have I felt that a situation is hopeless or that change is impossible. Despite the uncertainty that change will bring, there is nothing to fear from seeking genuine and lasting peace." So the question I have to ask to you is, do you continue to hold to that conviction even in the face of what we are now witnessing in Gaza? This is a situation that has challenged that proposition from the very beginning.
Yeah. It continues to do so.
And continues to do so.
But you see, this is also the story of my life.
Yes.
You know, I mentioned the communique of the party that we had never heard of, the FLN mm-hmm. in Algeria. Mm-hmm. It sounded crazy. Mm-hmm. It has been extremely costly,
yes.
but we made it. In Palestine, to be very, very blunt,
yes.
the Israelis and those who support them around the world, including in this country, or perhaps paramount in this country, have started to think of the Palestinians as a nuisance. Mm. But the Israelis were doing what's necessary to get rid of this nuisance. Mm-hmm. Kill a few, if you get a scholarship in the United States and you come and study as a Palestinian, you are not sure to be able to come back. This is what was happening until the 7th of October. For the first time, I know that there were some horrible things that have happened, but what has also happened is that Palestinians took the fight inside Israeli territory. And have defeated for one day the Israeli army. This has changed things throughout the world, not only for the Palestinians. So now it is a thing that people are starting to accept that the nuisance is not going to go away. That the nuisance are people who have rights, and they are not going to give up those rights. And the world is moving along with that nuisance that doesn't want to go away. In the Security Council, there was a draft resolution, by the way, introduced by Algeria, who is now a non-permanent member of the UNRWA, asking for the Palestinians to be a full member of the United Nations.
Yeah.
In the Security Council, the United States was the only country that voted against this draft resolution. Two other countries abstained, the UK and Switzerland, and 12 countries voted for. Then it went to the General Assembly, and there 143 voted for, 25 abstained, and 9 countries, the United States, Israel, and 7 others, voted against the resolution. So, you know, things are changing. And, you know, from the river to the sea, which is the slogan that, you know, is some people say this is the horrible thing that says that the Israelis are going to be thrown into the sea. Yep. No, sir. No. First of all, this is an Israeli slogan. And if for Palestinians and their supporters it is a slogan, the Israelis are doing everything to make it from the river to the sea for themselves without the Palestinians. They are doing things every day. And in Gaza, what they have been trying to do is to push at least half the population outside into Egypt. They have failed to do that. At what cost for the Palestinians and the inhabitants of Gaza? So this is where we are.
Yeah. But let me ask you, because we do have to sort of close this. You know, we have seen recently in the press references to an effort, a diplomatic effort, to reach an agreement that would have specific recognition for the establishment of a Palestinian state.
Yeah.
Do you think, you know, this is one of those situations, do you think that in the midst of the current crisis, it might just be possible to leapfrog all the obstacles that we have encountered for so long to that goal of the creation, the realization of a two-state solution? Do you think diplomatically, if you...
I'm aware that you don't have much time.
Yeah.
So I would say simply this.
Yeah.
Israelis and Palestinians today, you know, because you know what a lot of people in the West say, let them negotiate. If you let them negotiate, they have negotiated for 30 years.
Yes, that's right.
And if they negotiate, they will not be able to reach an arrangement. They need help.
Yes.
And that help can come only from a united international community, the United Nations. Accept the state as a member, and then you will have the state of Israel occupying the state of Palestine. And you need to help them arrive at an arrangement between them. That is the way to go. It will not be done in 1 month or 1 year or even perhaps 5 years, but it can be done. And I think it will be done if the most important countries in the United Nations really live up to their responsibility.
Yeah. So one final question, because you see in the audience here lots of young people. The future peacemakers and peace builders of the world, you yourself have always been a strong advocate for, supporter of the role of youth.
Sure.
In involving themselves in these issues of peace and stability and security. So what would you wish to share with this group of young folk who are here looking at the extraordinary example of your own career and life?
You know, we are not handing you over A perfect place, to say the least.
To say the least.
Yeah. But you see, when I was your age, I wasn't handed a perfect place. On the contrary, it was a very, very imperfect place. You know, I remember even after we gained independence, and at what price? I remember the demonstrations led by Bertrand Russell in London against nuclear weapons. In those days, nuclear weapons were—people were thinking that the nuclear war is tomorrow.
Yeah.
In the United States, in particular, people were building, underground shelters and stacking, food and water and so on. And we thought it hasn't happened. It hasn't happened because of, people acting in wherever they were sitting. And we have lived through that period, that fear, and arrived at the end of the Cold War. And we thought that, now things are going to be different. It hasn't lasted very long, and now we are, 2 years, no, 1 year ago, I was terribly scared that a war is not avoidable. I'm very happy to see now that China, Russia, the United States do not want a world war. But they may slip in it very much. And this the young people can prevent. Your leaders, even in Russia and China, cannot ignore your voice. Just as your voice in support of the Palestinians is not ignored. So, good luck to you.
Ambassador Brahim, you have been extraordinarily generous, not only with your time. You flew all the way from Paris to join us here today. Generous, most of all, with your thoughtfulness and your wisdom.
Thank you very much.
I just want to say, on behalf of all of us, how grateful we are you for the fact that you've graced us with your presence and for sharing all that wisdom with us. You've offered kindly, actually, to come back and continue our conversation, or perhaps particularly speak to some of our educational and training programs. And believe me, we will be knocking at your door to follow up on that invitation.
If I'm still able to walk with my stomach.
In any event, may I ask everyone to join me in expressing our gratitude.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.